It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfworth. You know, Anchorage may not be known as a drama capital like London or New York, but there's a lot of good drama that happens here. And what you may not know is there are plays that are written in Anchorage that go on to be performed elsewhere and that are pretty darn impressive just to see here in town. And we have one local author who has a play off-Broadway in New York, which is just finishing a successful run and will be going to other cities around the world, who is going to be our guest today on the show. So that's our topic today, Anchorage playwrights, and sort of this link between Anchorage and the rest of the world in the artistic world, how you write a play, how you turn your life into a play. Lots of things to talk about. It'll be a roundtable, I think, of three writers talking about playwriting and how our community links into the rest of the world. So my guests today are Dick Reichman, who is author of several plays, actor in many others, director. You've seen him on the stage at Cyrano's, and you've heard him on the air here at KSKA many times. Thanks for being with us, Dick.
Thank you for having me.
And David Holthaus, who I admit is the inspiration for our show. David's play, Stalking the Boogeyman, has been on the stage off-Broadway after a successful run with Large Houses and is finishing up, I guess, this week. David is a writer for the Anchorage Press and has been grew up in Anchorage, and his work is sort of going to the next level where all authors will be envying him. Thanks for being with us, David.
Thanks, Charles. Good to be here.
So tell us your play was part of your life story, and it started out as a newspaper piece and then became a radio piece and then a play. Just sort of tell us this story of like how this piece went from one step to the next to the point where you're having the New York Times make it a critic's pick and writing these rave reviews about it.
Sure. Stalking the Boogeyman was originally published just over 10 years ago by the Denver Westward, an alternative weekly in Denver. So I originally wrote the piece for them as a staff writer there at the time. And then it was republished on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News and the Anchorage Press up here in Anchorage. So your listeners may remember it from being republished in the spring of 2004. And then about 5.5 years passed, and I got a call from one of Ira Glass's producers for This American Life, who said that she had been waiting for This American Life theme to come around that she thought would be appropriate for the piece. And she asked if I'd be willing to collaborate with her and Ira on transforming the first-person essay into a piece for This American Life. And I agreed to do that. And it's been broadcast originally in early 2010 on This American Life, and then it was rebroadcast about 2 years ago. And when it was rebroadcast about 2 years ago, Marcus Potter, who's the artistic director of New York Rep, the theater company that produced the play, Stalking the Boogeyman, heard it and reached out to me through American Public Media and asked if I would be interested in collaborating with him on transforming the This American Life radio broadcast into a play for the stage. And so it was about a 2-year process of he and I working together to essentially adapt the original first-person essay that I wrote for The Westward into a full-length play.
And so it essentially came to you, and we'll get into the topic of what the play's about later, but it seems like you produced something of great impact, and people found it and came to you, and so you ended up participating in the writing of the play, although you didn't do the entire script. But now that's turned into a broader career direction for you, and the thing is really going places.
Right. I mean, during the course of collaborating with Marcus on the play, I was, you know, we got to know one another and became close friends. And I told him about some of my work as a journalist, including work covering right-wing extremist groups, in some cases working undercover, going undercover as a neo-Nazi skinhead. Or undercover with a right-wing border militia. And the more we talked about it, the more he said, you know, there's a play in there. And he also was very encouraging with the writing that I was doing on Stalking the Boogeyman. I mean, this is the first sort of stab I'd taken at writing a play. And he was very encouraging. He said, you know, you've got this. You can do this. And as a writer, I've toyed around with writing screenplays and wrote one that that sold and was never made, but it never felt natural. And writing plays does. That's just the best way I can say it. It just kind of works for me. And so before Stalking the Boogeyman was even started its run in New York, Marcus offered me a commission to write a play all on my own for New York Rep that is now scheduled to go up in September 2015, also off Broadway.
Deadline pressure.
Indeed.
So your career as a journalist mainly was years spent as a working for weekly newspapers around the country. And I noticed that the Playbill sort of called you a gonzo journalist. And I think of that as being sort of like the Hunter S. Thompson, wild on drugs, writing about rock and roll and stuff like that. Is that what you're trying to say with gonzo journalism, or what does that mean to you? And sort of how has your career brought you here?
I would say even by your definition, I qualified as a gonzo journalist for most of my 20s, into my early 30s.
All right.
So I would no longer identify myself as a gonzo journalist in that vein, but I still describe myself as a journalist first, who right now is dabbling in playwriting. In terms of self-identifying.
And it gave you a lifetime of material, and that's the first thing that writers need.
That's right.
Yeah. So, Dick, your path into writing plays is completely different. It's more from sort of the creative angle and the dramatic angle. And some of the topics you've chosen, of late at least, have been a lot about art, a lot about creation. I was particularly impressed with a couple of recent plays that you wrote that were on stage at Cyrano's here in town. Audition, which was really about actors and how they feel about performing and how they're developed as performers. And Bruckner's Last Finale, which was about sort of a creative genius and the torment that he goes through as he creates and the disconnection he feels with the world through this inspiration that puts him outside of humanity in a way. Really big, challenging topics, and it's obvious that you've developed your craft as a writer for a long time in order to get there.
Well, thank you for saying that. I'm very interested in the artistic process, and I admire the composer Bruckner tremendously. I love method acting. The play The Auditions is about method acting, so they became subjects about which I had a passion, and so I wrote about them. I've written about a lot of different subjects in my life. I wrote a play about the oil spill, which was a passion of mine for a long time as well.
And that got a performance outside, right?
Oh, actually, yeah, that was performed in Sydney, Australia. It's my only play that's been been performed outside. I have a friend down there promoted to a small local theater company, and I found it's very interesting. They have such a similar oil business. People came to see that play about the Exxon Valdez. They knew all about the Exxon Valdez spill. They knew all about the oil company politics. Anyway, I think it's interesting that David's play is dealing with a subject that touches a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I see in the theater is if you can do a subject that is somehow closer to the center of people's lives than just a piece of entertainment, that is a good venue for serious theater. And of course, David is dealing with topics here that are so deep, so essential to the functioning or dysfunctioning of society that it's a wonderful thing when theater goes there.
Right. Well, I just want to get into a little bit of the local scene and how it seems to be developing talent. Shotzi Schaefer's is another local playwright who I had on my TV radio show a year or two ago talking about the plays that she's written and produced and have gone around the country to different festivals. You have been there at Cyrano's developing your talent. It seems like there's a nurturing thing that's going on there, whether it translates into national productions or not. There's a space there where you're able to experiment and create.
Well, in my case, I have to give it to Jerry and Sandy Harper at Cyrano's, who gave me the space to direct and to do my plays at Cyrano's. Really, it's they have made that space. All my life, I've been writing plays and putting them in a drawer. Suddenly, I meet some people who are willing to let me put them on.
So it's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we have a discussion of three writers here. I also am a writer, and I'm hoping that Dick can help me question David about his work and about his development process, and we can just have a, open three-way conversation. But we also invite you to get involved in our conversation, whether with observations, questions, or comments about the local drama scene and the national scene in terms of how we can relate to it. The phone number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can call toll-free at 888-353-5752. And email is a great way to get on the air at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And if you don't know about the work that we're talking about, you can go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and just scroll down to today's show on Alaska Playwrights, and you'll find links to reviews and information about the plays that David and Dick Reichman have written. So, David, it's the subject matter of your play is really tough. You were raped at the age of 7, and you sought revenge. And at some point, you were ready to write about that, and then to even see it up on the stage, and presumably now it'll be performed elsewhere. I think that just the tough nature of the subject matter is one that makes obviously people uncomfortable, and also leads to the really intense drama of the piece. And I guess to start with, I'm just interested about how you made the decision to make this part of your life public, which most people I think would be nervous about doing.
Well, for 25 years, I kept it a secret. And the only people who knew were me and the rapist. And then my parents happened to find a diary that I'd kept when I was 10 years old, about 3 years after the sexual assault occurred, in which I'd written about it happening. And I have, to this day, I have no memory of writing that diary. And once they knew, I immediately wanted to write about it. The only thing I think that had been preventing me from writing about it was, frankly, not wanting my mom and dad to know that it had happened.
You wanted to protect them from it.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And now that I'm a father myself, I have a little bit of an understanding of what it has put them through. I just sort of had an instinct to protect them from the knowledge when I was growing up. Well, after a few years had gone by, once I was growing up, and then into adolescence and early adulthood. But, you know, now that I'm in my early 40s and have a son, I just, you know, I can't imagine what they went through and what they're still going through today, having known that happened when I was 7 and then not finding out about it until a quarter century later.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, in a sense, the guilt of just not, of the fact that you were suffering and they didn't know would be very, very painful for them, I'd think.
Yeah. And you know, you did mention that I was seeking revenge, and that's the dramatic tension in the piece and in the play.
That seems like another thing that would make you not want to let people know that you actually considered and planned to kill a man.
Yeah, I was about 10 months into plotting to do this man harm. Well, there's no need to mince words. I was planning on shooting him to death, and I was less than 2 months away from the window I'd given myself to carry that out when my parents found the diary. So I consider myself very fortunate. Yeah, in a parallel universe.
Their finding the document stopped you?
Yes, because after they found the diary, they first contacted the rapist parents, and you know, what I think is the most powerful scene in the play. Is David's mother calling the rapist mother and sort of telling him, your son did this to my son 25 years ago. And I hope that he spends the rest of his life in prison. And sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
No, well, we were talking about about the decision to disclose that to the world. And I guess maybe that's part of the kind of writer you were. You were already writing about and making yourself a piece of your journalism, and maybe because I think a lot of people would be puzzled about the fact that you could even talk about this.
Yeah, and the truth is, I don't know if I would write that piece today. I mean, I was just thinking about this, talking about this with a friend over this weekend. I don't know if I would have the nerve to write it today. I'm in a very different kind of writer than I was. Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned gonzo journalism. I was. Full tilt all the time. And what that translated to was just sort of like brutal honesty about myself with readers. I mean, I didn't hold back. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say my first...
And you did stuff like hanging around with street gangs, hanging around with neo-Nazis.
Yes.
Yeah, militia members and just getting into what they were doing and writing about it.
Yeah, yeah. As the character says in the play, the darker the better. that's what I was seeking out. And but again, as soon as my parents knew that it had happened, my first instinct was to write about it.
Well, one of the things that's striking about the piece, which I was glad to be able to see last month in New York, and I took my kids to it, is the incredible intensity of it and the fact that there's no let up. And the reviewers noticed this too. You are drilled into your chair, and when you get up, you feel like you've been just through a PTSD situation. I mean, it's so intense for every minute of the play. My son, who's 15 years old, said, "Oh, we're going to your friend's play. You know, oh, this will be great." And when he got up, he was like, "Wow, I thought I was going to be bored, and I didn't even like have a chance to breathe." And as he put it, he said it was maybe only 90 minutes long, but it had like enough drama for 5 hours because every scene is just this intense piece of drama. I guess it strikes me that obviously you're not lucky to have had this horrible trauma happen in your life. But not many people are given a topic like that to write about that is so overwhelmingly dramatic, especially for your first time out.
Yeah, you know, I have a hard time when people react by coming up to me and saying like, "Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you," because I don't want to say that I'm thrilled to have been sexually assaulted when I was 7 years old, but I don't know anything different. That's been my whole life, but I feel very fortunate to have grown up to become a writer and to have that outlet for the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I expect that you've probably received a lot of feedback from people who have had similar experiences. And I know some of the reviewers have thanked you for bringing this taboo material out into the public and allowing people to see it and deal with it.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. And that's been one of the most intense things about being back in Alaska after New York, is that here in Anchorage, people recognize me. And so it's a pretty common occurrence to have people come up and say, you know, either I've never told anybody this before or I've told very few people this, but it happened to me too. And I was this old and it was this person, and they feel like they can disclose it to me. And it's intense is a good word for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and if you want to get on the air to talk with David or myself or Dick Reichman, the phone number here is 550. Wait a minute, I got to put my glasses on so I give you the number correctly. 550-8433, 550-8433, Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Dick, this source material is kind of unique, and I think all writers have to draw from something personal in order to express themselves, in order to put something on the stage that's real. Is that true for you? I mean, are you in some ways always retranslating your experience into words and onto the stage?
Oh, actually, no. I tend to think that depending upon my own, writing about myself, my own life, my own history, is a kind of self-indulgence that will damage what I'm writing. So if I am writing about something that happened to me, I'll change it or alter it. I want it to be out there a little bit. And I'm just listening to David talking the huge success and artistic triumph that he has had by going deep inside himself and pulling out all that stuff. All of which I'm avoiding. don't touch that. It'll mess up the play. I'm not going to go there, you know. Maybe I'm in total denial. I don't know.
But when I see, when I saw Audition, I saw, my God, Dick has been in probably a million auditions, a million drama classes. And so he knows what he's talking about here, and there's something that he's putting across from his life experience. True or maybe not true? Is it
well,
all
actually, I did not learn that in drama classes. Where would I go to drama classes? I spent most of my life as a disc jockey in AM radio stations around the country, and then I came up here to Alaska. So, in fact, most of that was reading about drama classes. I've taught a lot of people to act as a director. As an amateur director, I've taught amateur actors a lot about acting as I've grown older. So a little bit of that experience, a lot of reading about classes. A lot of people tell me about their Meisner classes and their Stanislavski classes, and they knew these famous directors back in the old days, and so on. So I've talked to a lot of people about that.
So this is a great topic.
I didn't do the classes.
Imagination versus reality, and as a fiction and nonfiction writer, I've certainly found that nonfiction is much easier because you have a reality in which you can engage and then try to translate to the page, instead of in fiction where you're trying to create something and then have this additional issue of, like, is it real or not? So
fiction writing to me is like wizardry. I don't know where I would even start. I would be staring at a blank screen for days if I had to write a piece of short fiction, let alone a novel. And like, Dick, your approach to writing plays, that just, do you just pull them out of thin air? I mean, how does that work?
It's a lot easier than finding out the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a journalist. You got to find out the truth and write about it. But yeah. I just make stuff up. That's a lot easier.
All right. Let's go to Jocelyn, who is calling in. Jocelyn?
Hi. I'm full disclosure. I'm working with Dick Reichman at this current time on pre-production for a play which I have written. And my question is really the subject that Mr. Hofhaus has used is intense and dramatic and moving. My play is much quieter. It's about Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. How does a playwright get to the point where that kind of quieter piece has the same kind of exposure?
Oh,
and get out in the world.
Getting out in the world and exposure is the mystery that we would all like to know the answer to, right? I mean, because how many people are there out there who have scripts or screenplays who they can't get on the stage at all? I mean, you have a production and people will see it, but many more scripts are written than are ever produced. And David's story, I think, is interesting in that he didn't actually set out to have anybody produce it. It all came to him, right? So you don't know.
Incredible
that.
Amount of luck.
Yeah,
that's right. You know, that's right. But I think
have written something good to begin with. There's more than just luck there. You have to have something good in your package before they come to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, do you want to comment on that sort of? I mean, now you've got actually an opportunity to do much more work, and you're talking with. I guess the play is going to be produced in other cities, and there's possibility of a movie. You want to talk about that a little bit?
The play will be produced next year in Los Angeles, and it looks very likely that it'll also be up in London next fall. And talking with some other regional theater companies too. And of course, I would love to have it produced up here in Alaska. I mean, childhood sexual assault is such a huge issue up here, mm-hmm. and you know, this is my hometown. So,
right. And potential movie, or is that something you can talk about?
Yeah, I don't mind talking about it. I'm seriously considering two movie offers right now, and I don't mind being frank that it's, you know, I'm weighing how much I want to be involved creatively in making a movie, because stalking the boogeyman, the story, it does take an emotional toll.
How long do you want to spend with this material? You've been with it for 10 years already.
Exactly. And it's just the play is going to be probably another year or two. I mean, I'm starting to think, like, when am I going to move on from this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you did stage talks in New York for the first, couple of weeks of the show? Where after the show was over, then you'd answer questions.
While the show
audience.
Was in previews, we did mm-hmm. stage talk. It's interesting that the publicists were concerned that if we did stage talks once it was open and critics were coming in the early nights, that something would go awry with the that their review would become more about the talk back with the audience than it would be about the play itself, because the talk backs can get pretty deep.
I bet.
Yeah.
So I want to, you know, from my perspective, like, how does your work break through? And I've written 10 books, and several of them have been with they've all been almost all with national publishers. And when I look back on how that took place, it was very much like David's situation. You know, I spent tons of time trying to sell stuff in different places and nobody ever bought it. And then when people came to me, actually got my literary agent, because I was writing travel books, and a literary agent was coming to Alaska and reading one of my travel books. And
this is a travel book that you wrote that got you started.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows the answer. I mean, you can do fantastic work and never get noticed, and then you can do fantastic work and get lucky. So it's a good question, Jocelyn. I wish we had an answer for you.
Well, I can say that I really look forward to seeing the play when it does make Anchorage, and I'm sure that it will.
Yeah, I think it'll probably be a financial issue because it's expensive to bring outside drama to Alaska.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Dick,
thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling. And if others who may have questions or comments, the number here is 550-8433. And email is hometown at alaskapublic.org. Dick, you did this play about Exxon Valdez, and I was present when there was a discussion afterwards, which was quite broad-reaching and at times I found pretty emotional for those of us who had been through that disaster. And it was interesting for me because I sort of got my big start as a writer writing on the subject of the Exxon Valdez.
And that play wouldn't exist if it weren't for your articles. I archived all your writing about that spill in writing that play. Without those articles, there'd be no play.
Wow. I had no idea.
I didn't give you any credit in the script, but I mean, there you go.
Well, that's why I had no idea.
No, so it was all your writing about the spill. That's where it
I'll be looking for some residuals. But what was interesting to me is to see the events translated artistically. Obviously, it doesn't look or feel like the real thing because there's been this transmutation of the people and the characters and the way that they're responding to each other. And I guess from your point of view, you can't really worry too much about being exactly on what happened because you are creating something that's new. It's drama, and you weren't there, and you can't. There is no glass mirror to the past or window to the past.
Well, I like to think of it a little more self-flatteringly. There is a kind of fiction that goes beyond the literal truth and getting to the essence of the event. If you can find a dramatic event that may not exactly have happened, for example, in that play, there's a friendship between Frank Iarossi and Joe Hazelwood. I don't think that friendship actually existed, but by putting that into the play, I was able to hopefully get closer to the larger truth of the moral situation in which those two men found themselves. So I guess I'm saying that it's good to lie.
Mm-hmm.
If you find the right lie, it's better than the truth.
That's where you
somehow
find it,
sums
yeah.
up more truth. I don't know.
and then in Bruckner's last finale, again, it's the life of a real person, and yet you've obviously completely transformed it artistically. And the truth there is this truth about how artistic creation takes place and how inspiration and reality relate to each other. And I have this sense, I mean, Peter Porco's performance in that play was amazing, but I have the sense what we're seeing is your mind and Peter's mind. And I don't know if we're seeing Bruckner's mind, and I don't really care because he's dead and gone. I'm much more interested in the truth that you're putting on the stage.
Well, I like to think that, and a Bruckner fan said this to me once, that you have captured something about Bruckner's compositional style in writing that play. So I like to think that impulses that came from him are driving it, I like to think.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your case, David, I noticed in watching the play that even some of the language was exactly what I had read and what I'd heard on This American Life. I mean, it was extremely close to reality. There's very little attempt to transform it. I mean, you're really trying to put the exactly what happened on the stage.
Yeah, the wall between the stage and the audience comes down quite often in Stalking the Boogeyman. And there's probably about 25 minutes worth of material where the actor playing David is directly addressing the audience and is using practically word for word the original language that I wrote in the first person. So,
what were some of the changes that you had to do to get from a straight narrative into a dramatic piece? You had to dramatize some material that had not been dramatized.
Yes, you had to develop the characters of David's parents and the boogeyman's parents, and had to, you know, there were parts in the original piece where I was describing, for example, there's a part in the original piece where I described coming back to Anchorage when I was in college and going to buy a suit at a store that some may remember, Harry's of Hong Kong, which mm-hmm. we kept the name.
Oh, I
love
all the Anchorage place names for anybody who was in New York seeing
right.
this. You just wanted to yell, "Yay!" I saw.
And I hadn't seen this guy, the perpetrator, in a decade or so. And it turned out he was a salesman there at at Harry's of Hong Kong when my mom and I showed up there to get me a suit. And so it was much more effective to dramatize that scene and to write it out as a scene with David and his mom going into the store than it was to have the character of David on stage describing it. So it was figuring out, to answer your question, Charles, it was figuring out which parts of the original piece that I wrote were best kept in first person with David speaking directly to the audience and which worked much better as scenes.
Mm-hmm. And we need to go to a break here, but I just have to ask this question. There are six main characters in the play, you, the rapist, and the parents of the two boys.
Right.
And I assume your parents have seen the play.
They have not.
Oh, really?
They haven't seen the play, no.
And that was a conscious decision that it was just something they didn't want to do, or do you want to share about
it? I think
that?
They do, and I think that if and when it comes to Anchorage, they'll go see it. They're not avoiding it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just New York's kind of a long way to go.
And we don't know what the other three people think of it.
Right.
Yeah.
No.
And do you know, have you ever heard from this guy again after you confronted him in that final scene of the play?
No.
So somewhere out there, he's potentially experiencing this.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that part of my motivation was to seek revenge, and then once I knew that I couldn't do him harm because his parents knew that my parents had found this diary, and there'd be a link between he and I. I won't deny that there was a sense of wanting payback by writing about it then.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Do you still feel that, or is that?
Yeah, you know what? If he's out there and he's scared about whether or not his name is going to go public as a result of all the publicity surrounding the play, if he has fear, that's just fine with me.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good time to take a break. And I see that Sandy Harper is on the phone, and so we'll talk to her in the second half. And we'll be talking more with David Holthouse, author of Stalking the Boogeyman, and Dick Reichman, a local dramatist, when we continue. And I'll be giving out our phone number and email address if you want to get on the air with us. So stick with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about Alaska playwrights, and two of which are in the studio with me, Dick Reichman, who's written many plays that have seen local production, and David Holthouse, whose play Stalking the Boogeyman has been on stage in New York, a huge success, received great reviews, and now is going worldwide, and David is working on another play that can go on the stage in New York next year. And A lot of interesting and tough topics to talk about today. David's play, Stalking the Boogeyman, was about the fact that he was raped at the age of 7 and then stalked that person as an adult and perhaps could have killed him if not having the information come out. An extraordinary plot, really, that sounds like something out of fiction, but in fact is reality and has been translated into drama. So if you have questions on any of this or comments or just want to get on the air and talk with one of the three of us, the phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433 in Anchorage. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752, and you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'd like to go to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Sandy?
Yeah, well, hi. You know, actually, I was in New York last week, and I was in a full house with a standing ovation for David's play. It really was wonderful, and of course, I hope I get to do the Alaska premiere of it.
And just to introduce Sandy, are you the owner or the director of the...
I am the producing artistic director of Cyrano's Theater Company.
All right, good.
Yeah, and we, part of our mission is to nurture and cultivate, especially Alaskan playwrights. Of course, Dick is in reality our resident playwright. We've done over 9 of his plays, some of them commissioned, some of them he comes and he's had an inspiration and he wants to write a play about a certain issue or idea. And so you're talking about from page to stage. A play, of course, is the thing always, but what makes it come alive is a collaborative creative process. They're set designers, they're light designers, they're directors, they're the actors, and that's what makes it all happen, too.
Well, one of the things that always amazes me, especially about Dick's work, is that you're working with this palette of very few colors in terms of it's a very small theater and you don't have really elaborate sets. And if I think about a play like the Exxon Valdez play, you'd think, well, we're going to need a tanker and we're going to need beaches and we're going to need all the, and you think, well, there's no way you can do that. But then somehow the playwright is able to either just say, well, whatever, they'll figure it out, or to just imagine it in that setting. And since you've produced so many plays, you can probably see in your mind how it's going to look on the stage.
Well, that's always a big choice, but the wonderful thing about the stage, as opposed to film, is that the stage is its own space. When we go to see a film, we really see that fourth wall. That's life. It's got to be life. But the audience will forgive you on a stage if you say, hey, this is a stage. David's play, for example, is a mixture of scenes and narratives. You couldn't do that on a film. Mm-hmm. But yeah. On the stage, you can get up there, narrate it, and break into a scene and come out of it because the stage is its own place.
Yeah, that's a good point. Sandy?
Well, for example, in a play Alicia Jones wrote, who also a wonderful playwright, in the middle she just casually says, a volcano explodes. So it's a challenge, and that's the fun of theater, to be resourceful and figure it out. After you do, you say, wow, that was obvious, but that's the fun of the creation of a play.
Well, it's also the pitfall. Is it, does it work, and is the audience willing to suspend disbelief? And I've seen plenty of bad plays where I would say the answer to that was no. On the other hand, often the most powerful drama, I'm thinking particularly of like a play, you know, like Beckett's work, Waiting for mm-hmm. Godot, is self-consciously unrealistic and yet dramatically super powerful. But I want to ask David, like, how did you, when you were working on this, you never had any thought about how it was going to be produced. Did you have, when you were working on the script, were you thinking, like, how the heck are they going to do this?
No. But Sandy mentioned the collaborative process of theater. One of the things that surprised me most during the Stalking the Boogeyman writing process was very late in the game. It was actually once rehearsals started in New York, once the play had been cast, and we were a couple weeks into rehearsals. I was sitting on rehearsals every day, very intense, very long, 10 to 12 hours days. But we did some significant rewriting after we were already in rehearsals based on things that we were seeing during rehearsals and also based on input from the actors. And Dick, I don't know, has that ever been your experience? I mean, is that typical in theater?
Well, unfortunately, in the smaller venues, we're in a pretty tight schedule. Most of the productions that I have done, I've been part of it. I've directed or acted in. And usually there's a tight schedule, so I know I've been part of productions that start to rewrite in production in this way, but our rehearsal time isn't that long, and I often think to myself, gee, it's too bad we made that choice, but we got to open the show.
Sure.
Maybe next time we do it, we'll fix that.
I wonder if there's a difference of working with a professional repertory company as well.
Well, I think if you actually talk about having 8, 9, and 10-hour rehearsals, we at Cyrano's or other small groups here mm-hmm. in town, we're working with a working cast.
Yeah, I mean, a day job.
There are people who get up 8 o'clock in the morning, get off at 5:30, grab a bite to eat, run over to have rehearsal, maybe dropping the kids off at an after-school activity on the way, and so you don't want to hit them with a bunch of rewrites a week before you open.
Mm-hmm. But a play, original play, grows in the process of when it's performed. Actors find things, and sometimes the director finds things, and sometimes the playwright does as well, because it's a live, magical thing.
It struck me, David, that you weren't in New York that long. You and I were working on a project prior to your departure, and then you're gone. And then the next thing I know, there's a review in the New York Times, and it seemed like it wasn't that long a time period between when you left Anchorage and when the play actually went up. Tell us about the time frame of how long it took from sort of final script to, like, we're going to produce it to then it's on the stage, and how that ran.
Okay, so, right. So, let's see, the play premiered actually in North Carolina, in Asheville, North Carolina, last September 2013.
Oh, I see.
And so Marcus and I, at that point, had already been working together for about a year. And then they cast Stalking the Boogeyman in, I want to say, late July and early August. And they started rehearsals in mid to late August of this year. And then I was in New York for all of September. So I was there for the last 2 weeks of rehearsals. And then it opened in premieres in mid-September, and then officially opened September 29th.
So how long were these changes you're talking about going on? Was that all down in the previews in North Carolina?
We actually still know, but I could say that it was when I saw it on stage in North Carolina that I sort of went, aha, and realized how to fix five or six very serious problems in the play. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we had gone back and forth about whether or not to open it in North Carolina or whether or not to have the world premiere in New York. And I'm very glad that we opened it in North Carolina and that the North Carolina Stage Company, the company there, was willing to roll the dice on it. But even in New York, even once the play was in previews, there was one night where the cast and the director and I were sitting around. It was probably about the night of the fourth preview, and we were basically sitting around having beers after the play, and came up with a couple lines that were great that we wrote in the play at that point. That really, you know, was okay. Well, this is what previews are about. We'll try that out tomorrow night and see if they land. And they did, and so we kept them. So they're in the play
and
now.
And you're
so,
working,
I mean, to Sandy's point, it is. I think the play is sort of a living creative organism,
right?
Yeah. Well, if you're writing in a bar, that makes you a gonzo playwright.
But you're also working with professional actors who have been on Broadway, who've been in numerous television shows and movies, and so you could throw something at them and have them do it in front of an audience that night. Whereas, as good as the community players might be, they don't have that level of experience, and as Dick says, they don't have 100% time to put to it.
Right.
So that must be a real pleasure to be working with people of that caliber.
It was an honor, yeah.
Yeah. So it's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about playwriting with David Holthaus and Dick Reichman. David's play, Stalking the Boogeyman, is on the stage in New York. And if you'd like to join us to talk about drama, playwriting, or just the artistic process, the phone number here is 550-8433, outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and email is a great way to get on the air with us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. During our brief break, Dick was raising a question which I was also interested in about what it was like to see yourself, your parents, these other people you knew in the roles of actors. And how they had interpreted those words back and sort of seeing part of your life on stage. And I have to admit that the actor who played you, I thought was very good, but he wasn't at all like you. He was quite different in my opinion.
Right. Yeah. I think it was very, you know, when the play played in New York, in North Carolina, I only basically met the actor who portrayed me on stage during the performances, and I didn't really get a chance to know him all that well, unfortunately. But Roderick Hill, the actor who plays me in New York, he and I got to know one another, but we were very standoffish with one another for the first couple weeks of rehearsals. I think he and I kind of did not want to I don't know if to poison the well. That's not the right terminology. He and I were both sort of leery of him trying to emulate me as a real living person in front of him on stage. He had already established who the character was.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So
you're not trying to portray somebody that everybody
knows.
Right.
And then after a couple of weeks had gone by, then he started coming to me and asking me questions about how were you when you were, what was it like when you were going out to like buy the gun to do this or things like that, and he sort of incorporated that into his work. But the toughest thing for me was in working on the writing of the play, writing dialogue especially, was getting over kind of the hump of like, well, that's not how my mom would actually say that. You know, when I was writing dialogue for the actor playing my mom and the actor playing my dad, I had to get over trying to make it sound like my mom and dad because it just.
Well, how did you do that? Did you create a different character in your mind so you could deal with it?
Yeah.
How did you go about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Uh-huh. I had to.
So it's not your mom and dad anymore.
Right. I had to stop thinking of it. I had to stop imagining my mom and my dad saying the words.
And what about yourself? Did you step aside from yourself
well,
as well?
Almost all the dialogue that comes out of the David the character's mouth is words that I words that I actually wrote in the original piece,
which was what you actually said when the incidents took place.
And the climactic scene of the play and of the piece that the play is based on is a confrontation. It was when I confronted the rapist 25 years later. He and I met on the streets of downtown Denver, and I was carrying a bag that had it was wired for sound. So I recorded that entire conversation, and the conversation is basically transcribed in the piece and is described word for word in the This American Life episode. And the dialogue on stage in the play is 90% exactly what was said.
And where was this meeting? On the street?
Yes, on the 16th Street Mall.
And you just happened
Denver.
To be carrying a tape recorder in your brain?
I wired up that.
You wired it up for it?
Yeah, because at that time
was
a planned
confrontation that took place. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, and that scene is an incredible power and just is almost unbearable to watch because it's so real. And the actors do a fantastic job of putting it across. And I think, frankly, the essence of the piece and why it's so powerful is this redemptive quality that comes through, which is the fact that we're the perpetrator of the rape is apologizing, apparently very sincerely, and yet we don't know if he's sincere. And he's saying that this is the only time it ever happened. And he seems very sincere, but we don't know if he's sincere. And in This American Life piece, your skepticism is more clearly conveyed. On the stage, it doesn't have to be because we know, well, he may be lying, and we don't really know if he is lying. And so we're wanting to think of this as a redemptive story. You didn't kill him, so it's better that you didn't kill him. And he's suffering because of his regret. His regret is obvious. At the same time, we have all this additional layer of skepticism. So it creates this very powerful kind of an unreliable narrator thing that's happening for the audience that is, you're a brilliant guy, but I don't know if you could have created that, right? And the fact that it's real is also a big part of it.
Yeah, what I find in the talkbacks with the audience is that a lot of times people who have just seen the play, they want me to tell them whether or not he was telling the truth. You know, they're like, well, which is it? Is he lying or is he telling the truth? It's like, you tell me. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. That is one big change between the source material and the play is that it worked better for the play to have it maybe be about 50-50, is he lying or telling the truth? Mm-hmm. You know, as you said, David's skepticism doesn't come across as strongly.
Right, and in the written piece, you sort of have to state your opinion. In a play, you don't.
Right.
Yeah. So this issue of when you write and then you see your words on stage and you see actors transforming those words, is that some part of the pleasure of it, Dick? I mean, you've written something, you don't know how an actor is going to perform it, and then he performs it, and maybe they come up with something better than you ever thought of.
Yeah. The situation is very different when you're writing fiction, as I am, according to what David has really got the things rooted in life. Yeah, it's either better or worse. if you have really good actors, they'll add layers of stuff you never thought of. That's what you hope for. If they're bad actors, they may layer stuff in you don't want.
Right.
You want to get rid of that.
Well, I think people wonder, what does the director do exactly? Because especially if you're working with actors who maybe can't put it across, you can't make them into good actors, right? How do you make your vision come onto the stage if it's not working?
Well, I think that acting is concentration, and if people in the theater, we have a lot of developing actors that we're working with here in town, and I think that people who are doing poorly, I mean, if they're interested in going on the stage and trying out for a play, they probably got some talent in them. And if they're concentrating correctly, I believe, maybe it's mythology, that they can give a great performance, experienced or not. It's the focus. It's the living in the moment. It's the understanding of the text. It's the personal, all the stuff that makes performance. You can do it through concentration. It's true. Someone who's done it for 30 years and has a great voice and great body movement is going to look better. But you can make it happen tonight if you concentrate and prepare.
Yeah, David?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question, Dick, which is that how is your playwriting different, if at all, when you know that you're going to direct the piece?
It isn't, because I like to think that I can hand it off to another director. And in some cases, I've been able to. But there's also the thing, if you are a director, one's skills as a director play into your writing, and directing it is a way of testing all that out. Really, when you come down to it, acting, directing, writing, it's all one thing. It's just putting on a show. It's getting up there and doing something or getting people to do it for you. So it's basically all. I learned this from an old Broadway director. Mary Hunter Wolfe lived here many years ago. She was a Broadway director who retired here. And I spent a lot of time talking to her. And the main lesson was that it's all one. Everything about a show, from the design, the color of the set, to the high heels the actresses wear, to changing a few lines, to a few lines of publicity, it's all one piece. You don't divide up the work in the theater into these different elements. And she was a great visionary of theater, so I've always thought, you know, gee. And of course, I'm like many playwrights, unlike you, we actually get behind and push our own productions. There's nobody out there saying, may I produce your play? please come here. Can I have your material? Can we collaborate on this? So basically, you're driving this production entirely yourself. And I guess when I write a play, I figure I'm going to direct it. And if I pass it off to another director, it doesn't matter because that's already been factored in.
Yeah,
I get very upset when people go and they say, and I know this is often said in theater schools, take a director's class and the director teacher says to all the directors, okay, take out all the stage directions and start from scratch. People seem to think that somehow a director should rewrite the stage direction. Well, I know, this is a favorite theme of mine, I know from a person who directs plays, if I direct a play in Dramatist Play Service, I go to that stage direction that comes from the playwright and the stage manager. And I know as a writer, and you must feel this too, and when you write a script, that stage direction is very much part of that show. It's not something you want someone to peel off and change. It's just like peeling off the text and changing it. Anyway, that's my theme.
So I think that one of the interesting things about producing plays, and I bet a lot of our listeners have been in plays, even if only in school, is this collaborative aspect of it and the pleasure that is obtained from creating something as a group, and which is quite different from the writer's usual experience. You know, as writers, we tend to be solitary and we produce something and give it to the editor, and the editor messes it up, you know, and then you fight with them to get them to fix it. Well, occasionally you get a good editor who enhances it. I would say David's a good editor. I've had a few. I probably have had more bad editors than I've had good editors. In any event, you don't really feel much like a collaborator with your editor. Whereas in a play production, everyone's really working together, and you see that at the end, this wonderful camaraderie that comes about. I wonder if that was a new experience for you, David, in working on this play, and that it is a collaborative effort, and yet you've had an entire career of working sort of as a journalist on your own.
No, and it hooked me. I mean, I never realized until this experience how collaborative the theater world is, you know. And yeah, writing is lonely. And yet to be sitting in that rehearsal room every day with like this great sort of pirate crew of people putting something on was a rush. I mean, the only thing that compares to it really is I spend most of my days now with the Anchorage Press. And it's like, and one of the reasons that I do that is I like collaborating. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to say other than that.
Putting together a publication together. Though when you write a play, there's also a bit of letting go, because the actor is going to reinterpret it, the director is going to reinterpret it, and you're writing on a canvas of, you're sort of painting on a canvas of humanity, which tends to move around, as opposed to when you're writing, you put down your words and they are what you chose. Did that ever bug you at any time, or like, that's not what I had in mind?
No.
Really?
I mean, and if it did, we worked it out right away. So it was, it didn't have much time to bug me.
Yeah. It sounds like a really great experience as a first time of doing it. You know, I think you paid your dues through years of journalism, but now you're getting quite a reward, which most of us probably will not get.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. So I must say the rewards of working in the theater in this community, I regret not having mm-hmm. the play done in New York or Seattle or something, yeah. But the rewards of working with the talented people in this city, I could tell you tales just in the last year of just feeling huge success just by having wonderful people doing wonderful things. The satisfaction of getting a lot of productions, even if they're just in Anchorage, is huge. I couldn't be happier.
I'm repeatedly amazed at the quality of the work in terms of writing, acting, directing, and staging plays that I see in Anchorage. I'd see clunkers as well, but I think I'd see some of those if I was in a larger city. And then on top of that, the openness of the community so that you know people are trying out for plays and getting in plays, and then you see your friend on the stage and you go, wow, there's an aspect of a person
that I really feel like, I'm sorry to cut you off. I really feel like it's a theater town. I feel like Anchorage is punching way, way, way above its weight when it comes to theater. And I think that that was true when I was a kid here in the 80s, too, and that had a real formative effect on me as a writer, going to the Alaska Repertory Theater and Theater Guild and University of Alaska's plays. I mean, my parents had season tickets to all those companies, and it had a really profound effect on me as a kid. And so I hope that parents listening will take your kids to the theater.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, I don't think it's ever been any better than it is now, though. It really is pretty great.
Well, so I like to think, you know, a lot of talented people are trapped in their jobs up here, and we get to use them in the small community. There's no large theater here at this time, so we get some of these talented people that would, were they elsewhere, would probably be making a career in theater. And we get to use them in our little theaters here.
Yeah. So we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about what's coming up next. Dick, what do you have planned?
Well, actually, I've got one more weekend of a play called Night Mother, which I'm producing at Grant Hall. It's directed by Bob Pond, and it's a great example of some older theater artists who've come together to do some fine work. And
What's the play about?
Night Mother is a 1983 Pulitzer Prize-winning Broadway play about a middle-aged woman who comes to her older mother and says, I'm going to kill myself. And the conversation that ensues is the body of the play. Wonderfully intense piece.
So that's at Grant Hall?
That's at Grant Hall this coming weekend for the closing weekend. Mm-hmm. And I personally don't have anything else in the fire right now.
Okay. And David, you're working on something. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So the working title of the play is Gun Show, but it's about again, it's hewing close to real life experience for me. It's about a journalist who is undercover with a neo-Nazi extremist group, and you don't know that right away.
That's about again, are you drawing on a lot of tapes and real material, or is this more of an imaginative stretch in terms of creating something that didn't actually occur?
Yeah, this play will probably be about half fiction, half real life experience. So I'm gradually getting
this,
there.
Though. You did this. You were undercover in such groups.
So. On two or three occasions, just for a day at a time, yes.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah. So, and in terms of people who want to see Stalking the Boogeyman, they'd have to be in New York by Sunday, which is probably pretty unlikely.
Actually, it closed
last Sunday. Oh, it already closed.
Yes,
it closed last Sunday.
Yeah.
So they'll have to go to L.A. or London. But is there an opportunity to see it online or anything, or has there been any film made of it?
There's probably about 5 minutes of footage total online, if you want to see a few key scenes. Southern California, next August.
So the New York production, we can see pieces of the New York production online?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And does that mean that you're going to be going to help on those productions as well, or does it now sort of take on its own life?
No, I don't foresee sitting in on rehearsals. And I mean, at this point, we may still do some rewriting of the play. I mean, I don't foresee myself being as integrally involved as I was in New York.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of my guests. This has been a really interesting hour for me, and I suspect for our listeners as well. David Holthaus, author of Stalking the Boogeyman, Dick Reichman, author of Audition and numerous other plays. And next week on Hometown Alaska, Kathleen McCoy will be the host, and the topic is Alzheimer's disease. Mary Katsky has done a new film about it, and I think she's going to be Kathleen's guest. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.